only half the patients, you know, with a threshold disorder are recognized, and then only half of those who are recognized are treated. Only half of those are treated effectively. The clinicians are very capable of caring for patients effectively, but often the system fails us.
This is Contributing Factors, produced by Health Further. I'm your host, Caroline Leland. So far in the series, we've examined the personal experience of depression, the biological basis of depression, and the social context of depression. Now we want to zoom out to look at the context of the healthcare system as a whole. What are the structural barriers to effective care? In particular, what economic and political factors are at play in the way our healthcare system addresses mental health? We can't pretend to answer those questions comprehensively, but our interviews led us to some compelling insights. Before jumping in, I want to be sure that you know you can hear the full conversations with everyone we interviewed for this episode by going to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. Separately, please be aware that nothing in this episode can be taken as medical or legal advice. Now, the economic and political aspects of mental health. Chapter 11, The Overload. 24-year-old Lucero Cifuentes has major depressive disorder. It took several years for her to find a therapist she felt comfortable with. But finally, she started meeting with someone who could help her work through the many factors that were contributing to her depression, while relating on a personal level to her life background, especially her experiences as a Latina woman.
We just started off speaking in Spanish, and it just somehow my feelings were, I was somehow able to express it in a different way in Spanish. And I think it just, we clicked in a way that I have never clicked with any other therapist, because she understood. Like, she understood what I was going through. Like, she understood how I felt kind of alienated in the United States.
If only that were where this story ends.
I actually missed too many sessions. And so she was like, we can't have sessions anymore because your insurance isn't going to pay for it anymore. And I'm so stupid to have done that. But sometimes you're too depressed to go to the therapist that's supposed to help you when you're depressed. So I just wouldn't go. And I ended up hurting me.
Cifuentes feels frustrated because not only was she suffering from depression, but her insurance company wasn't fully protecting her from the real-world implications of her depression, like the fact that depression strips a person of motivation. Unfortunately, a symptom like that is hard to quantify and therefore hard to insure against.
I think I missed 3 sessions. Like, it wasn't even like a crazy amount of sessions. But I think, you know, people have to have a little bit more patience with that, obviously. I've been on so many medications that at this point, it's not elective. Like, if I needed electroshock therapy or I needed to do something like that, my insurance would have to pay for it. Because at this point, it's a health issue. And I just think it's interesting that it's not a health issue in the first place.
Cifuentes is pointing out that our healthcare system makes a distinction between mental health and what might be called physical health. In many respects, this distinction might be more harmful than helpful. After all, the line between mental and physical health is a continuum. The brain is an organ that requires a certain chemical balance to function, just like the rest of our biological organs. But there are distinct challenges in treating a disease that affects a patient's decision-making process. To what extent should a patient be held responsible for their behaviors when they carry a behavioral health disorder? To what extent is the healthcare system, or our tax dollars, responsible for providing treatment to patients like Cifuentes? There's no obvious answer to these questions. Cifuentes, for her part, argues that her healthcare treatment should be a right and not a privilege. If she were to seek out therapy again, she'd have to pay for it out of pocket. She's living in Spain and can only afford the most basic insurance coverage there. Her current plan doesn't include therapy.
It's like 200 euros a session, which I obviously can't afford. So it's upsetting that I can't get quality care if I want it. Like, I've been looking for therapists, and it's like, if there's one that's free with the insurance that I bought, then I would love to go. But everything is costing money, and I keep feeling like it should be a priority. My health should definitely be a priority. But when you're worrying about paying for other things and you realize that it's going to take away from maybe going out to dinner with your friends or something like that, then I right now it's like it would be a luxury to be able to afford to go to a therapist, which is pretty pathetic, honestly.
At least in the U.S., part of why mental health treatment becomes so expensive is because the system is overloaded and inefficient. Dr. Lorenzo Luases, a psychology professor at Indiana University Bloomington, explains that waiting lists at treatment clinics are way too long because treatment is delivered first come, first served.
A friend was telling me about a clinic in Indianapolis with a waiting list of 500. So if you call and you're the person 501, you have to wait for 500 people to be seen before you can be treated. Now we know from the research literature that anywhere from 30 to 40, 44% of those people are going to get better anyway, sort of a placebo effect. And that anywhere from 40 to 60% of them can respond to something like an app. So if you have something like the app as the first line intervention, as something you have to go through first before you can go get face-to-face treatment, then the people who are getting face-to-face treatment are only the people who didn't respond to the app. And so you're managing things a little bit more efficiently.
Rachel Massell, a clinical social worker in Austin, Texas, says that one of the largest barriers to care is a national shortage of psychiatrists. This is probably related to the fact that some insurers don't reimburse mental health providers well, which makes it harder for those providers to be able to afford treating uninsured patients, or to provide sufficient services to their existing patients, or to take on new patients. As a result, many psychiatrists and other mental health professionals decide not to accept many kinds of insurance. So even people with health insurance often struggle to find an in-network provider. One study found that in 2015, insurance companies reimbursed mental health professionals 83 cents to every dollar that primary care doctors were reimbursed. And this held true even when those providers were treating the same condition, like depression.
Even people who have insurance, who even have good health insurance through an employer with a low copay, they may not even be able to access therapy or psychiatry because the insurance company in their area has decided that their mental health panel is full, that they have enough clinicians, but they reimburse their clinicians so little that actually very, very few of those clinicians on that panel are taking more than a certain number of people with that insurance. So I'll have clients call me and say that they have called 20 other therapists on a certain insurance or who are listed as taking their insurance, and either they never get a call back or they're told that they're full.
Massell pointed out that those concerns don't even take into account uninsured patients, including those who are in states that did not take the Medicaid expansion and are therefore left without good coverage options. A 2012 court decision determined that each state retains the right to choose whether to accept the federal funds for health insurance that are allotted by the Affordable Care Act. In the 18 states that have not accepted the expansion, adults that fall into a certain income range, specifically below the federal poverty line but with income above 44% of the poverty line, they end up without coverage.
Some people will only have mental health coverage for in-network clinicians, but if all of those clinicians are full or not taking any additional clients because they're actually getting so grossly undercompensated, they're getting paid the same amount by this insurance company as they were in the early 1990s. They haven't raised their contracted rate for over 20 years. There's no incentive for mental health clinicians to join that panel and to be available to those clients. And so these clients' insurance may only cover in-network clinicians. And so if they see an out-of-network clinician, then they're paying market rate or they're trying to find sliding scale.
This shortage of clinicians and the simultaneous undercompensation of clinicians isn't just frustrating for patients. It's hard on the clinicians, too. Psychiatric nurse practitioner Mary Carter explains.
When you're talking to a patient and you have 15 minutes to follow up with how this medication is helping them, and they, in that course of 15 minutes, share with you that one of their loved ones has just passed away. As a clinician in that scenario, your mind immediately goes to, how do I get them to stop talking about this? Because I have 10 other people in the lobby waiting on me and I need to move these people through. And that is so frustrating. That's not why we went into this field. We went into this field because we love interacting with people. I can speak for myself personally. I love interacting with people. I love seeing people's quality of life improve. And I want to support them in those dark times and be able to meet with them there and allow them to process that for however much time. And I think having such limited time with patients because there's such an overload has been the most frustrating thing. And the thing that I've constantly been trying to find a way around, you know, or trying to find a way to change and whatever level I can, whether that mean I don't take a lunch break or I go in early, I stay late, you know, and that'll burn out the clinician. So then it's such a frustrating thing to try to have the desire to offer quality care and yet be limited by the system that requires you to see sometimes 30 patients a day, because otherwise the clinic can't pay its bills, especially when we're looking at, you know, Medicaid and Medicare patients. Reimbursement is so low. What we often see is that clinics won't even take those patients because it's not worth it for their provider to see that patient for 15 minutes because the reimbursement won't offset the cost of paying that provider for the day. So now you see more of that money issue come into play, and that's incredibly frustrating.
You go into this field because you care about people. And then your work, the way it's structured, dehumanizes your patients.
And I as a clinician, feel very frustrated with the quality of care that I've been able to offer in a system that's so overloaded and where people come through like a conveyor belt. And that's not how I want to see patients ever. And that can be so frustrating. And it can be a wall in conversation with administration because they're looking at the numbers, and sometimes they're powerless to change that.
Because the patients can see that the system is overloaded, they feel guilty for taking up space, which actually worsens their depression.
Just how persistent the internalized stigma around depression and really any mental health concerns is within the clients that I work with. Lots of, I shouldn't feel this way, I had a good enough childhood, my parents never abused me. Guilt is a symptom of depression, but they'll play it out in the therapy room as, I'm taking up a space that someone else who needs it more could be taking. And a lot of my intervention at that point is validation that what you're experiencing is real, it matters. It's painful, you're in pain, and if we're comparing our pain to other people's, we're really not gonna get anywhere. One person's stubbed toe is another person's broken arm. We experience pain differently.
Imagine the everyday struggle of a hospital administrator trying to manage these challenges. How do you accommodate for a growing waitlist of patients when you're understaffed and those few clinicians are sometimes underpaid? How do you maintain high-quality care in the midst of all that while protecting the well-being of your employees as well?
My name is Jameson Norton. I'm the CEO at Vanderbilt Psychiatric Hospital and Clinics. I have administrative responsibility to support all behavioral health services as part of Vanderbilt Medical Center. Part of our trade-offs that we deal with on a day-to-day basis is that challenge of providing good access to care and knowing that there is a very high and growing demand for services in certain demographics and certain diagnostic categories where we need to be able to expand that access, but also sustain the level of quality and support that we need to be able to do that in a personalized way and in a very effective way.
In other words, it's hard to maintain a personal touch when you're treating a whole lot of patients. Often the struggle to maintain that balance results in clinician burnout.
It's relentlessly exhausting at times, knowing that sometimes we'll deal with readmissions or a relapse that can be discouraging, or we can deal with really unique cases that we're trying to really identify what the condition is and what is going on with a particular patient. That takes tireless work, and it takes sometimes sleepless nights to be able to figure that out.
Norton says Vanderbilt addresses that challenge by working to support the emotional capacity of its staff.
that involves making sure that they are constantly reminded about the ways that they're making change, and the fulfillment aspect of our job is incredible. Because our staff, one of the biggest challenges is forcing them to take breaks at times. And those breaks become really important for our own personal welfare.
Providers face financial limitations on how many patients they can serve and what they can offer to each patient. Not only does this lead to clinicians being overworked and burning out, but it's detrimental to the patient's experience too, both in terms of how they feel about their experience and how accurate and effective their treatment actually is. For example, writing a prescription is less likely to be effective for a patient when the provider doesn't have time to explain exactly how it works. Here's psychiatric nurse practitioner Mary Carter again.
Our mental health system is really overwhelmed with patient volume versus accessible care. Patient visits are often so fast that the ability to truly talk to a patient and help them understand, here's what this medication's doing to you, to your brain chemistry. Here's why it's so important to take it every day. Taking the time to really educate a patient so that they don't go home and after 3, 4, 7, 8 days say, hey, I don't feel any better. This medication's not doing anything for me. I'm going to quit it. You know, that's oftentimes one of the biggest reasons people quit medication, and it's lack of education.
As illustrated by Cifuentes' frustration with the rules of her insurance coverage, the industry faces challenges in determining what a patient, quote unquote, needs to maintain good health. For example, health insurance is more likely to cover post-diagnosis medical treatment than any kind of preventative treatment.
Why doesn't our insurance cover yoga sessions or massage sessions or exercise classes? You know, things like that, that really could be preventative or even treatment for some of these depressive symptoms. But instead, we kind of have to get forced into a corner of using medication sometimes, because even therapy is not well covered by insurance oftentimes. And truly, people can't afford to pay whatever it might be, $100 an hour for a therapist once a week, you know, if they're already under financial strain. So there's definitely an imbalance in what the system will cover.
On the other hand, antidepressants are sometimes prescribed too quickly to people who might not need them, and not prescribed to people who might need them. Indiana University professor Lorenzo Luaces explains.
One of the things that you hear about a lot is that 1 in 10 Americans is on antidepressants. And what I used to think, which I think is what a lot of people think, is that this is the fault of psychiatrists and that psychiatrists are just over-medicating everyone. But what I actually found out in my research is that most people who give prescription for antidepressants are actually primary care providers, general practitioners. About 75% of prescriptions for antidepressants are made by general practitioners. And that general practitioners are actually doing most of the depression treatment. If you think about it, there aren't enough psychologists and psychiatrists to treat everyone who is depressed. And most people actually prefer going to their GP for mental health problems, which already is surprising. And what the research suggests is that primary care providers often miss depression. And so everyone knows that. But they're actually just as likely to miss depression as they are to say that someone is depressed when that person doesn't meet the criteria. And so that whole, the treatment of depression in primary care, the way that certainly there are a lot of antidepressant prescriptions, and it seems to be both over-treated and under-treated, that was something that really surprised me.
When we combine all of these issues, we end up in a system where treatment isn't as effective or efficient as it should be, for individual patients as well as the population as a whole. And that's if a patient even comes through the door and a diagnosis is made in the first place. Jameson Norton from Vanderbilt sums up these issues.
Only half the patients, you know, with a threshold disorder are recognized, and then only half of those who are recognized are treated. Only half of those are treated effectively. Clinicians are very capable of caring for patients effectively, but often the system fails us.
Those examples we just went over are just a handful of some of the systemic problems faced by mental health providers, payers, and patients. But why is this system overloaded and underfunded? Why, as Norton says, does the system fail us? Let's talk about the policies that influence these things and their economic results. Chapter 12, Global Economics and Its Personal Relevance. In addition to recognizing the emotional, social, human rights reasons why this is important, it's worth pointing out that mental illnesses like depression have massive economic consequences, especially when left undiagnosed and untreated. The annual economic cost of major depressive disorder in the U.S. alone is a staggering $70 billion in medical expenditure, lost productivity, and other costs. This includes costs from absenteeism from work, but also from a phenomena called presenteeism, when people still show up for work but are less productive because of their mental illness. Janet Curry is the Henry Putnam Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. She's also the Economics Department Chair and the Director of the Center for Health and Well-Being at Princeton University. As evidenced by her titles, she's an expert on the economics of health and well-being. She says the most common reason why adults lose work is not because of a physical health problem like a broken back or pulled muscle, but because of mental health problems.
And when people do lose working time because of mental health problems, they are out for longer and generate more costs than for most physical health problems. So it's a really big thing, which many people don't even think of as a health problem. That's part of the problem. It wasn't until recently that health insurers were mandated to treat mental health problems as health problems and cover them. So there's a lot of people out there who are suffering from mental health problems. Most mental health problems start in childhood or adolescence. They're often manifested first in adolescence or young adulthood. So they're really impacting people at the time when they would be going to college or starting a job or starting a family. You know, people really get derailed from having a productive life. So I think it's tremendously important and not understood just how prevalent these problems are and how much they're costing society, not just individuals.
Brazilian professor and researcher Denise Razouk, who recently published a book titled Mental Health Economics, elaborates on these costs to society.
40% of people don't receive treatment in mental health in high-income countries, and in low- and middle-income countries, only 20% receive treatment and care. Depression alone costs $1 trillion a year.
That's globally.
Because loss of productivity. We have a projection for 2030 that the cost of mental disorders will grow from $2.5 trillion now to $6 trillion in the future. This is terrible. And we must do something, and not only through policy. Everybody has some responsibility to change the situation.
Razouk says the biggest barrier to effective mental health policy is simply global society's failure to recognize the importance of the issue.
There are a lot of barriers, but I think that the low resource and investment in mental health is the hardest barrier. But this is very close and related to the problem of stigma against mental illness. The basis, the core of stigma is ignorance. People don't know what is mental disorder are, and people they think that people are weak and incapable to do anything, and they cannot live in society. And this we can change with knowledge, with information, with education.
For her part, Razouk runs a website that provides educational information on mental illness.
We need to talk about this. It's not only for policymakers. We need that people understand the importance of take care of mental disorders.
The biggest cost of mental illness, of course, is that of human lives. Depression in particular is a chronic and often fatal disease. That threat should not be understated. Clinical social worker Rachel Massell drives the point home.
Depression might become so acutely terrible that someone does think about or plan or attempt suicide. So there's a very real danger in having depression in a society that undertreats depression and has such barriers to care. We're talking about life and death often.
Chapter 13, Policy and Parity in Practice. What is the role of government in all this? You probably know that healthcare is a highly regulated industry. The U.S. government has passed numerous laws governing mental health. As always, it's up for debate whether those laws are effective. Federal policy is always hard to get a hold of because it's so broad and complex and has such a patchwork enforcement system. Princeton professor Janet Curry says the least contentious federal policy on mental health is a law called the Childhood Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP. Curry says research shows that child protective legislation like CHIP is correlated with far-reaching positive outcomes.
Several teams of researchers using different data sets and looking at different outcomes have found very consistently positive effects of kids having access to health care through the public health insurance programs. Higher wages, higher rates of college attendance, lower rates of disability, fewer chronic conditions, fewer hospitalizations for chronic conditions. It's kind of like any outcome that you look at, you see a positive effect.
CHIP was in limbo throughout the last few months of 2017, but in early 2018, Congress approved 6 years of funding for the program. A more controversial piece of federal healthcare legislation is, of course, the Affordable Care Act. Supporters of the ACA emphasize the law's role in protecting patients with pre-existing conditions, including mental health conditions. But an October 2017 executive order from President Trump gave states new ways to get around those requirements. Rules about mental health insurance coverage are often tied to the concept of mental health parity, which is the idea that insurers need to provide the same level of benefits for mental health treatments and services that they do for medical or surgical care. If it's not already clear why that's important, here's nurse practitioner Carter to explain.
Treatment for mental health should be covered in the same way that treatment for physical health would be covered, because as we were just talking about, it's biological as well as environmental. Similarly to physical health, many physical health disorders, they're biological, but they're also environmental, behavioral, so to speak.
Mental health parity has been protected by law for many years, with the protections building up over time. In our conversation with Jameson Norton, the CEO of Vanderbilt Psychiatry Hospital, we asked what federal policies he has been most grateful for. He named the 21st Century Cures Act, which passed in December 2016. This piece of legislation introduced the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, which established a new federal role, the Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders, and increased the availability of psychiatric hospital beds.
That was, I guess, the culmination of a decade of strong advocacy and legislation on behalf of mental health. And what that did is help to build on important innovations through Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act and called for increased investment in the space.
Norton's greatest frustration with federal policy?
There's a couple different areas that are still inconsistent with this idea of parity, one of which is the 190-day Medicare rule, which basically gives Part A only pays for up to 190 days of inpatient psychiatric hospital services over a patient's lifetime. That's a fairly arbitrary number and something that often leads to a barrier to care. And again, it's something that is not consistent, that you don't see on the physical health side, and is somewhat of a piece of legislation that is inconsistent with this idea of mental health parity.
Mary Carter, the psychiatric nurse practitioner, speaks to another limitation built into certain state systems.
Just even regarding access to care, at least in Tennessee, and there are several states across the nation who have granted what's considered full practice authority to their nurse practitioners. Part of the limit to access to care is, as a nurse practitioner in many states, including Tennessee, we're required to have supervision with a physician once a month, and they review 20% of our charts. And it's a great practice, and I've always had great relationships with my supervising physicians, but it is limiting. And being granted full practice authority would allow nurse practitioners specialized in mental health to be able to practice independently and open up a whole new caseload of patients who might be able to be treated, rather than having to be attached to this finite number of psychiatrists that the nurse practitioner has to collaborate with.
This idea of giving nurse practitioners full practice authority in situations where there are provider shortages could be a solution, or at least a partial solution, to the shortage. However, there are still some concerns about allowing nurse practitioners to practice independent of a supervising physician. They go through a different training process, and so the argument is that without the same level of training, they shouldn't have the same level of privilege or responsibility. As always, there are differing opinions on every new idea. We've heard from a lot of researchers and providers in this episode. What might a payer have to say on the topic? To find out, we interviewed an executive at the New York-based healthcare insurance startup company Oscar Health. He spoke to the differences between the approach of a traditional insurance company versus how Oscar Health approaches mental health coverage.
My name is Vint Mitta, and I'm a physician and I'm vice president of clinical operations at Oscar. Traditionally, mental health services have been handled by insurance companies as a separate service. At Oscar, we think that doesn't make a lot of sense, in the same way that you don't think of your cardiologist and your cardiac care as separate from the rest of your health. We don't think that care for your mental disease or mental condition should be any different. And so most health payers have maybe a separate network for mental health services, separate benefit structures. And we view the value of integrating those things together into a cohesive experience as very, very important. Mental health services are a small proportion of total healthcare spend if you count services that are directly mental health related. But we do know, and evidence in the public health space has shown, that mental health needs are a much, much larger driver of healthcare costs. And so for Oscar, the goal is integrating those services into the larger medical set of medical care for our members.
One of the ways Oscar accomplishes this is through the personal touch guidance of their customers' concierge teams, which consist of a few individuals who handle that patient's customer service requests through their time as an Oscar customer.
Our concierge teams view mental health as a crucial part of the healthcare experience. And so whether it's finding help, getting help finding a primary care physician, getting help finding a psychiatrist, getting help finding a neurosurgeon, it all comes through the same channels. On top of that, there's a number of good examples where our concierge teams are aware of all the care that our members are receiving and oftentimes connect the dots for our members. For example, if someone does have depression and our concierge team also knows that they're having trouble taking their medications for congestive heart failure, well, you know that those two things are going to be deeply related to each other. And it's good for the patient because it provides a better experience. And it's also good for society as a whole because it improves the efficiency of healthcare being delivered and lowers costs.
Meta says this integrated approach makes it easier for Oscar Health to adhere to mental health parity law.
We also try to go one step further and not just provide an equal access and an equal benefit, but also better integration of those services. And unless you integrate mental health services with medical, you aren't really solving the problem. And the mental health parity law solves the first step in that, but at Oscar, we're trying to go one step beyond that. A good example of that blurred line manifests itself in the Oscar Center, which is one of our primary care clinics. We have all of our providers there, whether they're NPs or physicians or physician assistants, are all trained in basic mental health services and how to address those as part of the primary care experience. But even beyond that, knowing that access is often a problem, we also have two mental health providers in our Oscar Center clinic who see patients, and half of the visits that they see are impromptu, meaning, or unscheduled, meaning a patient comes in thinking, you know, they come in for their annual physical, and after an initial discussion with our primary care provider, we feel that maybe they could benefit from some mental health services as well. And so they walk them right over to the next room, and that provides a much better experience and shows the continuum between physical health and mental health.
We asked Meta if there were any economic barriers that de-incentivize insurance companies from providing mental health coverage. His response was that Oscar's customer-centered integrated approach precludes any economic barriers that might have been.
Mental health services are not a cost, but they're a very important piece of the total set of healthcare services being delivered, and is oftentimes very value-add because it gives us good insight into the member, understands the interaction of their mental state with their medical condition, and is something to invest in. Of course, any healthcare service is a cost and there's economic considerations, but depending on your viewpoint, we're able to see the value of it.
Despite how ideal mental health parity might seem, its enforcement is questionable. A representative from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services explained that states generally have primary enforcement authority of making sure health insurance companies are adhering to mental health parity law. How that tends to shake out is that each patient is left responsible for knowing their own rights and for filing a complaint when they feel their rights have been infringed upon. A recent survey by the American Psychiatric Association found that more than 90%, that's 90%, of Americans did not know about the mental health parity law or did not know what it meant. Patients have filed complaints in a handful of states a handful of times, and so far those have always resulted in the insurance company in question adjusting their plans to align with the law's requirements. But imagine, if you were severely depressed, how impossible would it be to take the initiative and do all the paperwork and file a complaint against your insurance company? Plus, the law doesn't apply to everyone. Some government plans and programs like Medicare are exempt. And certain state government employee plans, such as ones that cover employees at state universities, can opt out of the parity requirements. The law also does not apply to employer-sponsored insurance plans when the company employs fewer than 50 people. But for those who are included in the law's jurisdiction, it's not terribly hard to get around it. At least parts of it. For example, insurers still retain the ability to deny a patient coverage when the insurer determines that the patient's treatment is not, quote, medically necessary. And defining medically necessary can be a tough thing to do, especially since it's tough to quantify mental health issues. This has real-life consequences. One recent survey found that insurance companies are twice as likely to deny coverage for psychiatric medications and treatments than they would for other medical treatments. Twice as likely. Norton implied that Vanderbilt adheres to mental health parity simply because it's the right thing to do. Oscar Health says they do it because it ultimately results in better patient outcomes. It's hard to get an involved player to give a straight answer on this, but our reporting made it clear that mental health parity law, though it's extremely important, is far from a silver bullet. Chapter 14, Some System Solutions. On the optimistic side of things, there are some solutions being developed for issues we've discussed in this episode. Dr. Jonathan Becker, an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, shared with us his biggest frustration and his biggest hope. His biggest frustration is the systemic limitations to a patient's treatment options, something we talked a little bit about in episode 3, which is about social factors.
I do primarily med management and offer, you know, more biologically based treatments, but I have a lot of patients that really need psychotherapy and I think need weekly psychotherapy, but there are so many oftentimes barriers to getting them that it can't happen. Some of that might be on the patient, either, you know, they're working, they have families and they don't have an hour in their week that they can come do therapy. Or providers are very limited and they just can't find anybody that is affordable for them or on their insurance panel that can see them. So that's my biggest frustration is that, you know, with some of these patients, it feels like you're treating with an arm tied behind your back at some point when they can't get all the services that they need.
The thing that gives him hope? A program developed jointly by the American Psychiatric Association and the Academy of Psychosomatic Medicine. It's called the Collaborative Care Model.
You would have a psychiatrist consultant, so that it works collaboratively with a primary care physician's office to provide first line, even second line, you know, mental health services. And that would be done through having a mental health worker embedded in the primary care doctor's office, like a licensed clinical social worker. So somebody that has training in mental health treatment and clinical expertise in that area as well. And they would kind of liaison between the patient, the primary care doctor, and the psychiatrist to provide comprehensive mental health care within the primary care setting, which would decrease cost for the patient, would increase access for the patient, and would take a load of burden off of both primary care doctors who are themselves, there's a national shortage of, and they're, you know, overwhelmed, as well as the psychiatrist. I would love to be able to help a primary care doctor manage first line, second line medication and never have to see them in my office or on my inpatient practice because we treated it quickly and aggressively, then that would also open me up as a specialist in psychiatry to be able to see the people that, you know what, we've, through their primary care doctor, we've run through first, second, third line agents. They're not any better. Maybe it's time then they come on and see me.
Like Carter's push for nurse practitioners to be granted full practice authority, this is just one idea for how to address some of the systemic shortfalls in how our nation treats mental health. There are others out there and we could spend limitless time discussing them. But for now, it's time to wrap up this episode. To learn more about global health economics, check out Denise Razouk's new book, aptly titled Global Health Economics. To learn more about U.S. mental health parity law, check out the show notes posted on the page for episode 4 at healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. And to learn about some of the innovative business solutions to the individual, societal, and systemic challenges we've discussed throughout the series, check in with us next week to hear episode 5, which covers the world of business and innovation surrounding mental health.
Of course, just the simple fact of being able to deliver care over a video conferencing platform has changed the delivery of care. We are treating individuals who have never received specialized behavioral health care before in their lives.
Contributing Factors is produced and hosted by me, Caroline Leland. The executive producer is David Schifrin. Our original theme music is written and performed by Matt Phillips. The track can be heard on his upcoming album, so be sure to check him out at ilikemattphillips.com. That's Matt with two T's and Phillips with two L's. Stephanie Edwards is our music supervisor. Matt Faulkner leads marketing, and additional creative assistance is provided by Michaela Powell. Special thanks to Lucero Cifuentes for allowing us to share her story. Many thanks also to Jameson Norton, Janet Curry, Denise Razouk, Mary Carter, Rachel Massell, Jonathan Becker, and Lorenzo Luaces. Contributing Factors is a Health Further production. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Play. For bonus content from this episode, including full interviews with everyone you heard today, go to healthfurther.com/contributing-factors. While you're there, you can learn more about Health Further and everything we have going on, and you can also find us on Twitter at Health Further. Please take a minute to rate and review Contributing Factors on Apple Podcasts, and then share it with your community. Your participation and support is what makes this show succeed, so thank you for being here and for helping spread the word. Join us next week as we discuss business innovation around mental health.